is Kevin Sandler for Spectrum. A pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. James Kembler on behalf of Grand Lake Health System and the Kembler Orthopedic Center. Dr. Kembler, nice to hear from you.
Nice to be with you again, Kevin.
Let's start by talking about, the walk-in clinics that are available. A lot of people may not know that you actually offer walk-in clinics, I understand.
We do, and there's a couple of different reasons for that. One is convenience. The other is just so that people can get in expediently as opposed to calling in and getting an appointment tomorrow or a week or two from now. We're very good at getting people in very quickly, even if there's a phone call to the office. But a while ago, we instituted a walk-in clinic so that if people had an injury the night before or even a few days prior, they could just walk in during these times. And we would honor that and get them in and see them as we would any other patient.
Outstanding. Let's talk about what kind of injuries can be treated at your walk-in injury clinic.
Sure. And maybe at the end of the discussion for walk-in clinics, Kevin, I can kind of dole out the times and talk a little bit more about how they can get in for that. So if somebody has a serious injury, if there's an open fracture or a laceration with bleeding, or they've got head trauma or multiple extremities involved, then they're going to need to go to the emergency room. Certainly, if it's a significant injury that needs more global treatment, maybe a CT scan or something along those lines, then they would need to go to the emergency room. And that's probably going to be pretty clear cut to the patient or parents of the patient, depending on age. But the walk-in clinic is really focused on smaller injuries, sprains, possible fractures, a sports injury that happened on the field, even if somebody's put on crutches and they prefer to come directly to us as opposed to going through the emergency room. Those are the kind of injuries that we can see. We can see patients in the walk-in clinic even from referral from Occ Health or the emergency room or a family physician, or directly by the patient's desire. What I might add to that, though, is we also have a very large workman's compensation practice. And if someone does have a workman's compensation claim, even if it's an injury that happened a day or two ago, we would want those patients to come to our regular office because there's a lot more paperwork and processes involved, and it just works a little bit better that way. But all other minor and medium-sized injuries or even just repetitive problems, pain in the knee or pain in the shoulder, we're happy to see people in the walk-in clinic or in our regular clinic hours.
Yeah, we talk about the difference, obviously, the walk-in clinic versus the ER, and certain injuries are, much more obviously an ER issue, but what might be some examples of when it's more appropriate to visit the walk-in clinic versus the emergency room?
If somebody has an ankle sprain, for instance, or they have a suspected fracture, at the walk-in clinic, whether it's in our Salina office, and I'll go over the times here in just a little bit, but or on Monday mornings and Wednesday mornings at Joint Township Hospital, we're already there operating, so we see people in the walk-in clinic in between cases on those mornings. They can come directly for those even if they've had pain in the shoulder from a working in the garage over the weekend, for instance. There are different levels of care, and part of the reason of coming directly to us, unless, of course, it's a true emergency, is that, number one, then it's not going to be two visits, the emergency room, and then to us for further care. But also, it's going to be a less expensive process. The emergency room is automatically a higher level evaluation and expense, and that's doubling or tripling the cost right off the bat. And if it's not necessary, we certainly don't want to take business away from the emergency room, but the emergency room is busy enough. They don't need to see the minor stuff if people can come directly to us.
Oh, right. And another thing I'm sure to mention is if you've gone to the wrong place, they're pretty good at letting you know, like, hey, you really do need to go to the ER, for example.
Correct. Now, if someone to our walk-in clinic and it's a much bigger problem, we may be the ones that need to do the surgery, but it might need initial evaluation through the emergency room. And conversely, Kevin, if somebody goes into they think they're going into the emergency room and they have a relatively minor problem, they may end up in urgent care, which is a lesser cost space as far as I understand. And or they may do a brief evaluation and then set that patient up to come over to our walk-in clinic, and then we can take over the rest of the evaluation, the rest of the care.
Let's talk knees. What are, you know, the most common knee surgeries that you perform?
Well, we perform just about every knee surgery that there is. And so maybe I can talk a little bit about some of the problems that might happen. I did a Tip Tuesdays on Facebook regarding younger age and teenage sports injuries. So maybe I'll focus on the adult cases here, although some of the older teenagers would apply to this as well. So keep in mind when you're at home listening to this and thinking about this, all ages apply. But this is going to lead up to a little discussion about knee replacements. So if somebody has a sprain of the knee, it could end up being just simply a quote-unquote sprain that we would treat conservatively. It could be an AC tear or a meniscus tear, which we'd obviously evaluate clinically, MRI if necessary. In almost all cases, we're going to be getting x-rays of any body part that has pain or an injury. And then meniscus tears and ACL tears might end up with surgery depending on age. Those are done arthroscopically, so in other words, scope, where we go in with three or more small incisions. We look around and we do some cleanup. We may trim up a cartilage tear. We may repair a cartilage tear, do an ACL reconstruction in the right age. Younger people who have an ACL tear are almost always going to necessitate an ACL reconstruction so that their knee is stable for the rest of the decades of their life. Older people, older like you and me, Kevin, I think I'm older than you, but we may, if we tore our ACLs, we might still be a candidate for an ACL reconstruction. But we might be that group that if we also have arthritis in the knee, the arthritis might trump the decision-making as far as a pathway of care. So there are multi-ligament injuries to the knee, and those tend to be higher-level injuries, reconstructable, of course, but those are bigger injuries. There's some minor fractures and major fractures that can occur around the knee, and we would treat those either non-operatively or operatively, depending on the magnitude of the problem. So if somebody comes into the office with knee pain without an injury, and they're adult, we're going to be working them up for certain things. It might be a meniscus tear, because as we get older, meniscus tears can happen more easily than being on the football field or the basketball court. We would be looking at x-rays for arthritis, remote possibility of a gout attack depending on the presentation. Hopefully there's not been any penetrating injury and therefore infection, although infection is always part of a differential when someone comes in with pain, and we need to rule that out most of the time just clinically. So if somebody comes in and ultimately the diagnosis is arthritis of the knee. We're going to start treating them conservatively, of course, because if we can treat somebody without surgery, especially in the early phases, we're going to do that. There are a number of people that come in and are ready for surgery, but sometimes we need to put on the brakes and explain that it might not quite be time for that, and or from a legitimate insurance standpoint, we have to go through conservative care so that we're treating them with all options prior to a bigger operation. So depending on the patient's background and medical history, allergies, et cetera, we would treat those patients with anti-inflammatory medications, oftentimes Tylenol in conjunction, bracing, oftentimes with arthritis, it's more of a compression type of effect as opposed to for stability, although some people with arthritis also have some instability in the knee, which can magnify the problem and their ability to walk without pain. Physical therapy on almost all these patients to work on dynamics, and I guess it's not a surprise, but a lot of patients say therapy isn't going to work, and then they come back after 3 weeks of therapy and they're markedly better because they're using the knee better. They're using the muscles around the knee better, and it's controlling things better when they're walking or going up and down stairs, for instance. The step after that would be, we call it lubrication injection. The more technical term is viscosupplementation. Viscous meaning thicker fluid. Kind of in layman's terms, what that's doing is helping aid to cushion the knee. Doesn't help everybody, but it does help 3 out of 4 people for about 6 to 9 months. So that's one of the reasons why most insurance companies kind of force us into those kind of things, because from the insurance standpoint, they're delaying surgery, but from a clinical and patient standpoint, there's times when they don't need surgery if we get to this point. I might bring up stem cells. We have a stem cell clinic. We don't do stem cells all that often because, frankly, we are very honest with all of our patients, regardless of the process, whether we're talking about knees or shoulders or any part of the care. But with stem cells, some of the advertising out there may be a little bit misleading. I'm going to say maybe because I feel it is misleading. It primarily, if we're using it for knee arthritis, it's primarily an anti-inflammatory effect. And about 3 out of 4 people are going to get some relief from stem cells. Even if it's a year and a half worth of relief, however, it is still a temporary treatment, and contrary to some of the potential things that might be said out there, it's not regrowing cartilage, and it's certainly not a permanent fix. So for better or for worse, most of the people that we explain stem cells to choose not to do it because it is an expensive process and it is out-of-pocket cost. The patients that we have injected have gotten that extended temporary relief in 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4 cases. So that is another option along the way. Go ahead.
I was going to add also, when people learn about the option or approaches for knee replacement, you offer like a sub-D is what they call it, and probably people do have questions about, knee replacement, and as you just mentioned, in so many cases, how it may be preferable to some of the treatments.
Yes, and I think, again, some of this is advertising. I've been practicing now for over 30 years, and with my training prior to that, 5 years of orthopedic training prior to that, we've seen the pendulum swing back and forth in a lot of different ways in certain procedures. And in our practice, whether it's shoulders or knees or hips, we are keeping up with the most up-to-date technology ideas, procedures, et cetera. But sometimes newer procedures aren't necessarily better, and sometimes newer procedures are actually a reinvention of a procedure that we were all using decades ago. And for a brief example, I'll use the hip, for instance, posterior approach versus anterior approach. 30 years ago, we were all doing both the anterior and the posterior approach. For decades, most of us went back to the posterior approach, and there's been a little resurgence of the anterior approach with kind of an advertising push that it's better. But most of that advertising is a little bit misleading, because if you actually look at the data, after about 3 weeks, there is no difference. In our opinion, we still do primarily the posterior approach because, there is a lower nerve injury rate, a lower fracture rate. There's no radiation in the emergency or in the operating room. And so sometimes it takes looking at the data instead of the advertising to continue to make a decision on what we offer patients and how we educate the patients that come in the office. So as you mentioned, with knee replacements, so if somebody's to the point where they need a knee replacement, we primarily do the standard medial parapatellar approach. It's been the most common approach over the last 3 decades. It works very well. There has been a little bit of a resurgence with the subvastus or the sub-V approach. And there's some advertising out there recently for a knee approach called the Jiffy knee, and that's J-I-F-F-Y knee. And for better or for worse, that is, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion that we've spoken with, people in different areas, different regions. This was an old procedure with a new name, and somehow a surgeon was able to, I believe, trademark the name, and therefore no one else, unless they bought into that program, can call it a Jiffy knee. But the sub-V approach that has been historically done for many, many years is basically the same thing. There's really no difference. There's probably 3 or 4 ways of doing the approach and dissection for a sub-V knee, and the Jiffy knee has taken one of those and modified it a little bit. But the crux of that is that if people are out there hearing about the Jiffy knee, it sounds like a new whiz-bang thing, but it's really an old approach that's been rebranded, and the sub-V approach is basically the Jiffy knee. So if anybody is hearing new stuff or confused about it, we certainly would be happy to sit down with them in the office and explain. And oftentimes with advertising, it's a bit misleading. The advertising behind this knee is that it takes 30 minutes and it's smaller incision. And on the whole, that really isn't true. Oftentimes it's a bigger incision because of the way the muscle has to be pulled over. Obese people don't qualify. People that are very muscular don't qualify. People with significant deformities often don't qualify, and people with significant limitation of range of motion pre-op don't qualify. So one of the pearls that I would like patients out there to take away, people listening, is that talking with your surgeon is probably the most important thing, because Googling things and hearing advertising can sometimes be misleading, and it's being advertised because that particular group or company is trying to bring in people specifically with that advertising tag. And there's even some data out there that regarding knee replacements that basically says, and backing up for a sec, one of the things that they tout with the Jiffy knee, so to speak, is that they can get up right away and weight bear right away. and it's a faster recovery and they go home sooner. But even with our medial parapatellar approaches, we weight bear them right away. We send them home the same day or the next day, depending on medical history. So a lot of push to advertise, but really, in our opinion, very little difference. But I think the crux of this is that whether it's a shoulder replacement or a hip replacement or a knee replacement or an ACL procedure, one of the most important things is finding the surgeon that can do what you want to do, but also listening, because that might actually not be the right procedure for you. And even more important is it's a quality surgeon and it's a surgeon you trust. So that's really kind of the crux of where I want to go with this is, you know, if you trust your surgeon, then that's the person that you want doing your knee replacement, regardless of the approach, because they are going to do a nice job with that particular approach, regardless of which one it actually is.
Let's also talk about the typical recovery time after a knee replacement using that sub-V approach.
Sure. Well, and again, we've kind of we've started to talk about it a little bit more to be able to answer questions that we're getting, because this Jiffy knee is getting a lot of press, so to speak. So ultimately, there is very little difference. Recovery from a knee replacement, really the most important part of recovery, in our opinion, is the energy that the patient has, their motivation to go through rehab, and how strong they were beforehand. So even with the standard medial parapatellar approach, we see people walk in the office 2 weeks post-op. You can hardly tell they've had surgery, and some of those people already have 0 to 115 degrees of motion. So there are so many variables. Excuse me. There are so many variables that ultimately delineate the recovery process. So in almost everybody, with knee replacements, unless it's a large revision case or there's some unusual process with the procedure, we are weight-bearing people right away. We get people moving right away. If they're healthy enough and want to go home the same day, we send people home the same day. They start therapy as soon thereafter as possible, working on range of motion, strengthening. So we don't hold people back, regardless of potential approach. We don't hold people back in terms of what they're doing. Obviously, they have to be strong enough to do things. This would apply to reverse shoulder replacements, for instance. We let them do whatever they feel comfortable doing. Now, we can't have an 80-year-old woman lifting 50 pounds right away. We don't have anybody lifting 50 pounds, I'm exaggerating. But, you know, a lot of the recovery depends on the balance and the strength of the patient. And then we move them along as they tolerate. So with any operation like this, the first 2 weeks are the toughest. Most people are back to fairly normal activities by 6 weeks, sometimes 2 to 6. And most people are back to normal activities between 6 and 12 weeks. And there's so much variability depending on the patient.
Well, Dr. Kemmler, as always, I thank you, for your time. I think it's been very educational for the public, and always good to catch up with you.
Thank you. And if I could just go back to the walk-in clinic hours are a little bit different every day. We've got morning and afternoon office or walk-in clinic hours on 3 out of the 5 days, Monday through Friday. We've got cards out there, magnets, bulletin boards, stuff. it's on our website. If anybody has any questions about anything that we've talked about or office appointment times and or walk-in clinic information, they can certainly call our office at 419-586-5760, and we'd be happy to expound.